You have reached a phone call from Paul, a Literary Hub podcast. To hear more, visit lithub.com. Part 1 of Paul Holden Graber's conversation with Eric Jarosinski.
Hello. Hello, Eric.
Who is this?
This is Paul.
Yeah, I suspected as much. You made me wait for your call. You made me very nervous.
I did make you wait for my call. Did it make you nervous?
Yes, I never talk on the phone anymore, so I'm out of practice.
It's funny, you know, this business of the phone becoming exotic.
That's right. I have to have a pretty important reason to call anyone these days. It's true.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why is the phone? Why do you have to have a pretty important reason to call someone? Is it that the phone is too immediate, too intimate?
It's just that you don't know what you're interrupting, essentially. I mean, I think we've gotten used to not being interrupted by communication and kind of getting to a text message or an email when you've got time to read it, essentially. And so I think that in a way it's almost like stopping by someone's house unannounced. That's a little bit what it feels like, I think.
You know, so the whole notion of the phone call, which in some way should be a way to connect with people intimately, has become something we avoid and that is disturbing. I remember the days when people had answering machines that they used precisely for that purpose.
Right.
You know, so that a certain romance would be created. You knew that, you knew when to call, not to reach the person, and to just leave a message on the answering machine.
Right. Yeah, I have some vague memories of that myself.
Do you like speaking on the phone?
No, not at all. No, I'm doing this despite the fact that I don't think I like speaking on the phone at all, except for job interviews. Well, job interviews on the phone.
Well, this isn't a job interview.
That I much prefer, actually. Otherwise, no, I'm not a big phone person.
So, you know, in a sense, I'm wondering if your preferred mode of communication, it would seem now, isn't a nice segue to our initial comments about the phone, which is that you spend a fair amount of time away from direct communication, though you are, in a sense, directly communicating with over 100,000 people through your Twitter feed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And often I might spend all day online and a lot of it on Twitter, but I won't check my email that all day, for instance. So that's, it's definitely the way in which things have developed for me. There's just, and I think partially it's just the fact that my old job as a professor, email has become such an important part of that job. And it's something that I felt like I was constantly distracted by. And for myself now, I guess I try to keep it at bay as much as possible.
And email, in a way, in that sense, in the way you're expressing it, is similar to the phone call. It sort of interrupts you from what you're doing.
Yeah, if you let it, yeah, definitely it's the case. Yeah. So and now I have a little more freedom not to let it.
Eric, tell me, for what did I interrupt today when I called you? What has your day been like?
What has my day been like? Oh, I was afraid you were gonna ask that, so you should have done something interesting.
No, you wrote this magnificent tweet before the weekend, precisely encouraging people to to waste their weekend away. That's what happens. So yeah. No, I'm not expecting you to have done 100 things. Don't feel the pressure.
No. Today was typical. I mean, I guess I've been following a lot of news today. I write my column for the German paper Die Zeit always very early Tuesday mornings, and so Monday in particular, I really need to get caught up with the news, and so I listen to two or three German, Austrian, Swiss radio stations, reports, go through three or four newspapers, some TV stuff. So that's what I was doing today a lot, and logistics for my never-ending failed intellectual goodwill tour, setting up some new dates, and that's what I spent a lot of time doing now. So a pretty typical Monday in that respect.
Tell me what this failed intellectual tour is about. I know a little bit from following your Twitter feed that
sure.
you're in some way your own impresario.
Well, that'd be one way of putting it. A bit of an amateur at it still, but I'm. I knew that I couldn't do a reading of the book that I did. It came out in the fall in US 9, a manifesto, because the texts are very short, for one. And two, I don't actually like to read them aloud at all. And so I needed to find some format for how I could present essentially texts that are usually at the most two sentences long. And so I kind of developed a way of doing... I guess you could simply say sort of a lecture, but I don't want to call it that. I want to call it more of a show, where I essentially play the straight man to kind of jokes that are told on the screen. And that's what I've been doing in various forms for the last, I don't know, I guess a little over a year at this point.
And you don't like the word lecture because it reminds you of those wonderful...
It reminds me of my old job, but also it has something to do with the fact that I... I'm trying to kind of find a different, sort of a different format and a different space because if people walk into something that's called a lecture, they're going to sort of react to it as one early on. I mean, you see people just when they enter a lecture hall, you get used to this as a professor and working different classrooms. People come in and they just take on a different posture and a different attitude kind of depending on where they're seated and what they're expecting to happen. And for me, lecture isn't what I wanted. I wanted something else, which is, in a way, going to express the fact that I'm working with a fair amount of fool's freedom in what I do now, and I kind of want people to join me in that. And so a lot of it is an attempt to kind of do some halfway smart jokes, but to do it without the pressure that people have to get it or people have to like it or that somehow it has to be that I have to have something important to say, because a lot of it's just fun, smart entertainment.
You know, I have the same aversion you do to the word lecture. I really don't like it. People when they asked about what we will do at the New York Public Library, and I veer away as much as possible from the word lecture. I've often been asked what is it, and I've come up with two words which may work for you too, which is
okay.
Cognitive theater.
Yeah, I like that. I could work with some version of that, perhaps, because that actually is something I'm looking for now, is sort of a name, because...
You can steal it.
Yeah, well, if I keep doing this, I sort of need a name for this genre, if you will, you know? It's and I don't really have anything yet, and that's one of my projects, is to come up with some good way of putting that so that I can... appear in lots of different contexts, because my best shows, that's usually what I call them myself, have been at bars or at a cafe or some unusual place like that that's not, you know, a lecture hall and not a bookstore, and that's what I'm kind of looking to do more of. Whatever it is that is required to kind of get my foot in that door, that's what I'm trying to do right now.
It's amazing to me how the way we speak to each other has changed so little. That, you know, a lecture today is probably not unlike a lecture 100 years ago. You know, that one hasn't, and the fact that you're looking for a new format, I think, is very, very promising. And I wish you good luck with that, because I think we need to find a new form of address, a new form of speaking to each other, a new form of conviviality, as it were.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, that was one of my big frustrations as a professor was, and in fact, that was the main thing I was trying to teach grad students my last few years was how to do conference papers differently than they're normally done, because that's, to me, always been one of the greatest frustrations, is that you have people with very interesting things to say, but formulated in such a way that no listener can follow them. And it often has the effect, in particular, of grad students or people who are not so been in a field very long, they end up feeling stupid, right? Whereas actually nobody sitting in this audience could understand what was being said or follow an argument because, you know, essentially it's a written argument that needs to be read and underlined and thought about, not simply listened to.
And in a way, it's the end of talent, isn't it? It's the end of talent when in fact you're going to something that is not performative, such as so many lectures, and you imagine yourself so much happier at home with a good glass of wine or a stiff drink reading it.
I would say it is performative, just as performative, but it's a bad performance.
Right.
The goals of the performance are different. I mean, when I was doing that early on, the goal was make sure nobody asks any questions. Because I don't want to be put on the spot, because I'm not going to have the answer. And in a way, it's sort of just a self-defense, protective kind of delivery. Whereas if you do it differently, and you can talk about a book that maybe half or more of the audience has never read, but you talk about it in a way that even they could ask a question about what you're talking about, you know, you're opening yourself up to communication, and that means, in a way, you're taking a little bit more of a risk, because you're actually talking about some back and forth. So I'd say it's performative. It just has a different function often.
So, you know, Eric, I've grown really quite a fan of your Twitter feed, and I've grown quite addicted to Twitter itself. It's an interesting mode of I don't know, is it a mode of communication? What is it, and what is it that you're doing? I mean, I just as we were talking, I pulled up your Twitter feed because I mentioned one tweet of yours that I very much liked before the weekend, and which gave me great hope that I was going to have a magnificent weekend. And and you say in it, weekends made easy: one, plan something; two, do nothing; three, regret everything.
Actually, I like the way you read these tweets. You've got the right voice for it. I don't know.
Well, maybe we should do something together. You know, you write them and I'll read them.
That might work, because I don't think my voice is the one that actually works with the way I'm writing. But I would say, I don't know what is Twitter. It's changed for me a lot over time. But communication, I mean, to be honest about it, for me, it's much less about real two-way communication these days. I spend more time writing Twitter than reading it. I don't try to have conversations on it. For me, it's actually more about testing out ideas now and experimenting with little forms. I mean, it's more of a notepad with feedback in a lot of ways. That's at least how I see it right now. And for me also, I mean, once you have a little larger audience, then you can potentially support projects that you and other people know about and so on. And so that's also an important part of Twitter for me as well, is sort of visibility for things that I believe in, want to support in some way or another.
But when you say a little bit of an audience, Nine Quarterly, which is at Nine Quarterly, which is your Twitter address, if that's the right way to speak of it, has over 100,000 people, 130,000 people.
But I mean, I have to say those numbers seem big. On a day-to-day basis, though, the world of Twitter is very small, I find. In terms of the active users, people who respond in any form, to what I'm doing on Twitter on a given day, might be a maximum of 100, maybe a couple hundred.
But that might be 99 more than if you were writing academic books.
Yeah, no, that's all true. But I mean, I guess I'd say is those numbers help. I mean, they provide a type of legitimacy in the sense of. Usually when I'm introduced somewhere, I mean, that follower number is tossed out there. And I guess it means something, but it means something a little bit different to me than it might to some others. Because you're also aware of, I don't know. I guess I would say the question of active involvement just being much less than the numbers. I mean, for me, that's always been part of the issue, is that... You have a certain type of breadth in your reach in terms of scale, but the type of interaction, at least as I use Twitter, is pretty limited. The quality of it is limited, and that's why I really see it more as this sort of notepad function. Whereas others use it much more as a form of dialogue and so on. That's just never been the way I've done it.
I'm going to read a few tweets throughout our conversation today. Another one, very recent one, I really took to, goes like this: "Ach, tweet that sent itself before it was completed. We'll never know what might have been. But I suspect it's better this way."
Yeah, well, that was simply written because I accidentally sent send on the tweet before then. It was cut off halfway and rather embarrassed by that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if this kind of situation happens often. I mean, it seemed to me that tweet could in a way stand in so beautifully for so many situations in life.
Yeah, sure. I suppose it could. It's but I think that one of the most popular topics on Twitter is Twitter. That is certainly the one thing that everyone on it can identify with. And then if you're going to extrapolate to something else, you certainly are welcome to. But that's sort of the origin of that. But yeah, it's a question of I really never know how people read these things. I just know that when you're writing, I always see, I mean, we were on the topic of interruptions before, all these tweets as little textual interruptions, because typically people aren't seeking out your feed and then reading through it. It's popping up, along with any number of other things that aren't connected to it, in their own particular timeline. So I try to write everything as sort of a self-contained little unit, one message, one bottle. And that's, again, part of that technique is sort of what you're referencing right there. I mean, this was in regard to, something that happened to me just a minute beforehand, but the idea is that it can stand alone without any direct reference to that.
One message, one bottle. I like that.
Well, that notion. Well, I mean, that would be the simplest form. I mean, the better you get at it, the more messages you put in one bottle.
And this leads me to a more serious question, perhaps. Before being a failed intellectual, you were an intellectual, and while you were an intellectual, you probably spent a fair amount of time thinking about notions pertaining to the essay, notions pertaining to the aphorism. And now, as a as a failed intellectual, you're writing in the grand, great tradition of the aphorism. And I'm thinking in particular, Eric, of some of the best aphorists like Champfort or Vauvenargue, so many of them, or Nietzsche for that matter, of Adorno in some way, though I suspect people wouldn't call him an aphorist, but there are aphorisms in Minima Moralia and in other places. And I'm wondering how much you've reflected on that. And of course, when I say failed intellectual, I'm simply calling you by the name you chose for yourself.
I don't know. I mean, I've taught them a lot, but I actually try not to reflect on it too much in terms of tradition. Part of the fun of this thing for me has been from the very beginning that it's all been about a type of praxis for me, and not about theorizing it while I'm doing it, at least not explicitly. And but I know that the aphorism is what I came to enjoy most in teaching, and what I found was most effective for me, because I'm actually someone who tried to write lectures and tried to give lectures and found I was terrible at it. After just really, really struggling at that, I decided I would try to do it a different way, and the way I ended up doing it was much more working with very short texts that I was reading with students together, whether it be in a small seminar or a big lecture hall. And I was all thinking about one text at the same time, and that's where I found aphorism so helpful. And for me, I ended up mainly teaching close reading, again, no matter what it is that I was teaching. Somehow that's what I was doing. And for that, an aphorism is great. They always say too little, and they say too much. And the whatever meaning you're going to generate and engaging with one is going to be negotiated in one form or another. And that's, for me, what the excitement has always been about in the short text.
And the concision, the kind of condensation that happens. I mean, it's nearly a haiku that you're trying to construct. And it brought to mind something that the French believe belongs to them, and something that the Americans believe belongs to them. This quotation that the French believe is Blaise Pascal and the American believe is Mark Twain, where one of them said, "If I had had more time, I would have made it shorter."
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what I like about it, in the sense that I think of what I'm doing is very much as a type of craft. And the concision is always the goal. When I've gone back over things that I wrote in the beginning, which at this point, I guess, is 3-4 years ago, most of it's not very good. Some of it, the ideas are okay, but they're poorly executed. And that's kind of how I see what I've been learning over the last years, is sort of bringing a certain rhythm into what I'm writing, and certainly working with concision. Because I think a lot of what people like about Twitter in general is, in fact, a certain elegance of the concision. That it's not always there, obviously, but that can be. Because I think that there's a lot that's said about people's short attention span, obviously, and distraction and so on. But there is a real appreciation for form on Twitter, I've found. Because often the things that I've written that most people responded to are things that are very carefully constructed. And often, you know, using classical rhetoric in its construction. And I think that there's something that still very much speaks to people in those kind of formulations. In some way, I would say, despite the fact of being on Twitter, but I also would say maybe especially because it's on Twitter.